Everyone, and thank you for joining us for the ADA Audio Conference Series. This is a program that is brought to you as a collaborative effort of the ADA National Network and the Great Lakes ADA Center. We're glad that you were able to join us today. We have people who are on the phone today using a variety of different methods. So some people will be on the telephone, and again, when it's time for questions and answer, as indicated earlier, we will take your questions and into the speakers. So in the webinar platform, you can ask questions through the chat area. We have some people also using both technologies. Captioning is available, so if you are needing captioning, use the CC icon in the top left-hand corner of the webinar platform. So welcome to our session today of Hot Legal Topics and Accessible Transportation. And our presenters today are Barry Taylor and Rachel Weisberg. They're with Equip for Equality, which is the protection advocacy agency for the state of Illinois. The biographical information was available on the website, so I will not take time to read that directly to you today. And we'll keep going with the session, and I'm going to hand it over at this time to Barry Taylor. So Barry, go ahead.
Thanks, Robin, and welcome, everybody. It's great to be here again. Today we are talking about hot legal topics and accessible transportation. And when Congress passed the ADA, I found that transportation is the linchpin which enables people with disabilities to be integrated and mainstreamed into society. So it's a really key component to the ADA, and I wanted to make sure everybody was aware today's training is not a transportation 101. Instead, we're going to be focusing on some recent legal developments, both in the courts as well as in the regulations that affect people with disabilities with respect to accessible transportation. And we'll be going through that and then available for questions on those issues once we get through those slides. So today we're going to be focusing on four major areas. First, I'm going to start and talk about some new developments with respect to air transportation, particularly under the Air Carrier Access Act. And then Rachel is going to be talking about recent developments with respect to ride sharing, like Uber and Lyft, as well as taxi litigation. Then we're going to shift back to me to talk about some recent developments in public transportation. Rachel will then talk about some recent developments in private transportation, and then we'll open up for questions for the remainder of the session. So the first issue we're going to be talking about are air transportation, particularly the Air Carrier Access Act. And as everybody probably knows, the Air Carrier Access Act was enacted in 1986. It was an amendment to the Federal Aviation Act. And this was added to the Federal Aviation Act after airlines were found not to be covered by Section 504 of the Rehab Act. And you might remember, too, in 1990 when the ADA was passed, it explicitly says that the ADA does not cover airlines. So the question that we have today to talk about first is there a private right of action under the Air Carrier Access Act? In other words, can a private citizen bring suit under the Air Carrier Access Act? There's no specific language in the Air Carrier Access Act about a private right of action, and so it's a little bit unclear. And initially, the courts had interpreted the ACAA to have what's called an implied private cause of action, which meant that even though it's not actually in the statute, individual private citizens could bring complaints in court under the law. And we've got a couple of citations of early cases that held that provision. However, in 2001, the Supreme Court decided a case called Alexander versus Sandoval, and it was looking at what you do when a statute doesn't explicitly say you have a private cause of action. Can you imply a private right of action? And that case, it wasn't about the Air Carrier Access Act or even about disability, but it was really is kind of given a kind of a guidepost as to what to do when you have these sort of situations. And the bottom line for our purposes today is it's very difficult to bring a private case, unless there is an explicit cause of action within the statute as opposed to this implied cause of action that had been used before. And since then, we've seen that courts have consistently found that there is no private cause of action under the Air Carrier Access Act, and we should have three examples of cases over the last number of years, the Lopez, Boswell, and Love case. So if there is no private cause of action, which is generally what's accepted today, the main enforcement mechanism under the Air Carrier Access Act is going to be filing a complaint with the Department of Transportation, and we're going to give you a link in a later slide on how you can file a complaint with the Department of Transportation. So we wanted to talk about what do you do when you bring a cause of action, an individual cause of action. Is there any way to utilize the Air Carrier Access Act? And the Gilstrap case is a fairly recent case which provides some interesting information for private litigants. This is a case involving a woman who had osteoarthritis, and she had asked for a wheelchair to assist her at the airport. She asked United Airlines assistance. And she alleged that United did not provide her with the assistance she requested. First, she said the employees were very rude, people yelled at her, said they didn't believe she actually needed a wheelchair, told her she should just stand, and there were significant delays in providing her a wheelchair when they finally decided to do so. So she filed suit in federal court, but she didn't file under the Air Carrier Access Act. Instead, she filed claims under state tort law, negligence claims, as well as the ADA. And even though she didn't make an explicit claim under the Air Carrier Access Act, what she wanted to do was use the standards that are listed in the Air Carrier Access Act to establish standards for violation of the state tort claims for negligence. And we have a citation here of what the regulations say under the Air Carrier Access Act. And it talks about how air carriers have to provide assistance in transporting passengers with disabilities through the terminal and that sort of thing. So she wanted to utilize the fact that this was out there, even though she wasn't bringing a claim under the Air Carrier Access Act itself. So the case made it up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the court declined to decide whether or not there is a private cause of action under the Air Carrier Access Act because she hadn't raised it, and so they avoided that issue. And then the question was, well, can she proceed with her tort law claims trying to use the standard from the Air Carrier Access Act? And the court said yes. But even though there's not necessarily a private cause of action under the Air Carrier Access Act, the standards under the Act itself and the regulations can be the basis for a state tort law claim. And the Air Carrier Access Act does establish the standard of care owed to a person with disability, like the standards I talked about before regarding assistance of airlines to provide passengers with disabilities, wheelchairs, and that sort of thing. So it allowed the tort claim to proceed using the standard from the Air Carrier Access Act, even though that actually wasn't part of the case, the Act itself. And then they moved on to the ADA, and they affirmed sort of what I think is fairly clear, especially within the ADA, is that you can't bring a case against an airline under the ADA. It's not considered a public accommodation under Title III of the ADA. So she was only allowed to proceed under the state law claims using the standard under the Air Carrier Access Act. And following this decision, the case was remanded back to the trial court and ultimately was settled. So since private citizens are likely unable to have a direct cause of action under the Air Carrier Access Act, it's important to look to what DOT, the Department of Transportation, has done to try to enforce air carrier access. And we've got a good example of a recent effort by the Department of Transportation. Again, United Airlines is the entity that they were looking at. And there were a number of complaints that were filed with the Department of Transportation regarding United's failure to do a variety of things, including providing prompt and adequate assistance on and off planes, providing assistance moving through terminals, and they listed a number of different cities where these were problems, and then also the problem of returning wheelchairs or other mobility aids promptly to the passengers with disabilities in the same condition. There were also concerns about people staying on the tarmac too long, although that wasn't really a disability-related claim. The agreement indicates that there was a significant rise in the number of disability-related complaints from consumers in 2014, and that prompted the investigation and ultimately the agreement that DOT reached with United Airlines in January of this year. They entered into a consent decree finding a number of violations of the Air Carrier Access Act. And ultimately, they agreed upon a $2 million fine to be paid for by United and also an agreement that United would cease and desist from this similar conduct. You've got a cite to the press release which gives you a little bit more details, but one thing I wanted to point out I think is interesting is that part of the fine, the $2 million fine, is going to be used to develop technology that assists passengers with disabilities who want to make requests for wheelchairs and other disability-related assistance at the airport using United Airlines mobile app. And so they're going to use part of that $2 million to change their app to now have provisions on the app for making requests for assistance while you're at the airport, which I think is a great change. The Department of Transportation also recently updated its regulations to address the issue of website accessibility in airlines. This was something that they put in place effective in 2013 at the end of the year. And basically the agreement is that, or the regulations require all airlines within 2 years, which would have been December of 2015 to modify their website pages with core travel information to make sure they're accessible. And then by December 12th of 2016, all their web pages have to be accessible. So it's sort of a phase-in of accessibility, with the core pages being accessible by 12/15 and all pages by 12/16. They specify that the web content accessibility guidelines are the proper standard to use, and they make clear that this applies to U.S. airlines, but also to foreign airlines, as long as the foreign airline has a website that markets the air transport to the United States. They also say that ticket agents must disclose and offer web-based discount fares to customers who are unable to use websites due to their disability. And then also, once the websites are accessible, the airline still must offer equivalent services to passengers, which is those who are unable to use websites, so that there is equal service for people who use and don't use websites. We've got a link at the bottom of this slide for more details about this agreement. Also wanted to mention that in addition to the website accessibility, this agreement or this regulation also addressed airport kiosks, which many people use to check in at airports. And those have to be accessible. 25% of them have to be accessible by the year 2022. So that's a longer term requirement, but that's something that we'll be seeing more of over the next few years. The Department of Transportation has also issued what's called a notice of intent. And basically what this means is they're looking at possibly issuing rules on a variety of issues. And the issues they've identified at the end of 2015 are accessibility of in-flight entertainment, supplemental medical oxygen, service animals, accessible laboratories on single aisle aircraft, seating accommodations, and carrier reporting of disability service requests. And what this notice of intent says is that a committee will conduct interviews and investigations on these various issues and give DOT a report with findings and recommendations. And then DOT will use that to decide whether to proceed with rulemaking on one or more of these issues. So this is more of a heads up. DOT is looking at some of these issues as possible new rules, but it's in the sort of investigation stage at this point. So stay tuned. Speaking about accessible in-flight entertainment, which is one of those issues that DOT is looking at, there has been an agreement that's been reached on this issue recently that may pave the way for some new regulations, and that is the issue of accessible in-flight entertainment with respect to a company called Gogo, which provides entertainment and TVs and movies when people are flying. And this is an agreement that was reached with the National Association of the Deaf. They were represented by the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, as well as the Civil Rights Education and Enforcement Center, two disability legal advocacy groups. And basically what they got Gogo to agree is to make sure that all of its in-flight entertainment is accessible to people who are deaf and hard of hearing. And they're going to be adding technology for customers for those, basically closed caption on the content that Gogo already has. And then as Gogo begins sourcing new content, they'll be adding closed captions with the goal of replacing all their existing source content with captions by June 30th, 2017. So that'll be really a big change for passengers who are deaf and hard of hearing to have more accessibility. And the agreement and more details about that can be found at the link at the bottom of this slide. We also wanted to talk a little bit about service animals, emotional support animals on planes, because it's different than what we're used to under the ADA and the Department of Justice rules. As you might remember, the Department of Justice really focuses on service animals and not emotional support animals, but the Air Carrier Access Act is a bit broader and covers both service animals and emotional support animals. The tricky part is that permissible questions and documentation really depends on what type of animal. Is it a service animal or an emotional support animal? Let me just go through sort of the differences here. If it's a service animal, the first thing you have to figure out is if the individual has an obvious disability and has one of the three categories. The animal's wearing a harness, tag, vest, or backpack. The person provides ID cards or other written documentation, or the person provides what's called credible verbal assurances that the animal is a service animal. And generally, what airlines should do is go to that third bullet point first, see if the person can provide credible verbal assurance about the animal being a service animal. And you really should only go to documentation if the verbal assurances aren't credible. And then if that all makes sense to the airline, they should permit the animal to accompany the person on the plane. However, if an uncertainty still arises after going through that line of questioning and review, airlines are permitted to ask a few questions. And the three that they're allowed to ask are listed here. First, what tasks or functions does your animal perform for you? What has the animal been trained to do for you? And would you describe how the animal performs this task or function for you? So that's very parallel to what the Department of Justice requires or allows for inquiries with respect to service animals. However, if it's an emotional support animal, it's a little bit different. For emotional support animals or psychiatric service animals, airlines are allowed to request more specific documentation, and they're allowed to ask for it in 48 hours in advance of the flight to substantiate the need for emotional support animal or a psychiatric service animal. Documentation doesn't have to state the person's diagnosis, but it has to be current, it has to be on the letterhead of a licensed mental health professional, and it has to state that the animal is needed as an accommodation for air travel or for activity at the individual's destination. So those are the things the documentation must provide in order to allow an emotional support animal. The other thing I just wanted to mention is that, you know, there are some provisions that talk about some other practical components, like the animal can't obstruct an aisle or other area needed for emergency evacuation. If you can't accommodate the animal at the location of the seat where the person with disability is, the airline is supposed to offer a switch to an alternative location. And also that airlines can deny a service animal in a cabin if there's a concern that the animal is a direct threat, meaning a significant risk of substantial harm, and somehow causes significant disruption in cabin service. So inconvenience of other passengers is enough, but if it's a significant disruption in cabin service, that can be a basis for denial of an animal on a plane. And then I just wanted to mention another case. It's not an Air Carrier Access Act case, but it does involve air travel, and I'll just do that to finish up and turn over to Rachel. And this is the RustGuy case involving a claim against the Transportation Security Administration, the people who check security at airlines. And in this case, the plaintiff had a metallic joint replacement, and under TSA security procedures, when she sets off the walk-through metal detector, you know, because she has the metallic joint replacement, she has to undergo a standard pat-down when there is no advanced imaging technology scanner. And she's concerned about the standard pat-down because it meant that people would be touching her breasts and groin area, and she found it very intrusive. So she tried to get TSA to change its protocols, and they wouldn't. So finally, she filed suit under both the Fourth Amendment, saying no unreasonable search and seizure, and Section 504 of the Rehab Act. And with respect to the Rehab Act, she had argued that it was relevant because the TSA security measures have a disparate impact on people with disabilities. More people with disabilities are going to set off a metal detector than the average person. And so what she had requested was that TSA conduct a metal-only search using a handheld metal detector. So if she sets it off going through the walk-through metal detector, they should use a handheld metal detector and not do the pat-down, because the pat-down is to find non-metallic weapons, and since she only would be setting it off because she has allegedly potentially metallic weapons, they shouldn't do the hand pat down, but instead should use this handheld metal detector. And the court found for TSA, they found, well, first of all, that the Fourth Amendment claim was not good because they looked at the public interest in thorough searches and security versus privacy concerns, and found, when balancing that out, that the security interest trumped privacy concerns. And then they also found that with respect to Section 504, you know, she really wasn't denied meaningful access to a program like you would normally be required to show under Title II or Section 504. And they said even if they were, to change the screening program just for her situation would be considered a fundamental alteration to the TSA security program that they don't have to do. And it would really change sort of the standard operating procedure across the country, and that would result in some confusion and inconsistency. And so they thought the request for the modification that she thought under Section 504 was not reasonable. And really, the bottom line was that extraordinary safety concerns that the TSA has to address is sufficient to refuse some sort of change, and therefore it was not a violation of Section 504. And then this last slide we have are just some resources for you. The from DOT, some different ones, including a new one for Guide for Air Travel with Developmental Disabilities, how you can file a complaint with DOT. There's a DOT hotline. We've got the link here. There's also a number you can call, which is 1-800-778-4838. You can file a complaint online or over the phone. And then also wanted people to realize that each airline has what's called a complaint resolution official at the airport or by telephone. If you have a disability-related complaint at the airport, you can ask for a complaint resolution official to assist you. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Rachel to talk about ride sharing and taxi litigation.
Okay, great. Thanks, Barry. And hi, good afternoon to everyone. So ride sharing and taxi litigation are two of these issues that have been getting a lot of discussion, especially ride sharing. And one of the reasons why is just the way that ride sharing companies have really completely changed the face of the private transportation industry in the last couple of years. And there's been this huge emergence of these businesses. And I'm going to mostly be calling the ride-sharing businesses. They have a whole host of different names. Sometimes they're called transportation network providers. But these, of course, are the companies like Uber, Lyft, Sidecar, that are the ride-sharing businesses. So just to give everyone a sense of really how large these companies are and what they're doing, Uber was launched in 2009, and since then has grown really rapidly. The last year I saw that it was worth an estimated $2.5 billion. And Lyft is smaller than that and was launched more recently in 2012, but it's still worth an estimated $2.5 billion. So again, these large companies that are really changing the pace of technology. So for those who are less familiar, the way that these companies operate is that by using an app, a mobile app on someone's telephone, passengers are able to connect with drivers in their area. And I'm sure most people have seen issues on the news and other places that there's just been a ton of complaints against these companies from passengers with disabilities, alleging that drivers and the companies themselves are discriminating against them. So one of the legal issues that we want to talk about today is something that we see often when there's this new type of emerging industry, and that is, well, does the ADA even apply? And if so, what provisions apply? And if so, what are those requirements? Well, we've got some good news and some bad news for you. Starting with the bad news is that there's no clear answer. You're not going to walk out of this training today knowing exactly 100% where the law is, and that's because we're still really new and these cases are just being decided. The good news is that there have been a couple of cases, and they have some guidance about what the ADA says with respect to these ride-sharing companies. So looking at one of the first cases that was filed, and that's a case called Ramos versus Uber Technologies. This case was brought by three individuals who have mobility disabilities and who use wheelchairs. And they brought claims against both Uber and Lyft. And what they said is that these companies are violating the ADA, specifically violating Title III of the ADA, in a number of ways. They don't have vehicle for hire services. They don't actually have accessible wheelchair accessible vans to serve people who use wheelchairs. The allegations are also that sometimes drivers are just simply denying services to people with disabilities. So maybe someone who uses a wheelchair who's able to transfer and needs assistance getting their wheelchair in the trunk of the car. Or another allegation is that the companies are providing no training about serving customers with disabilities. And there's no mechanism to even connect individuals who use wheelchairs with drivers who may have accessible vehicles. So the plaintiffs in this case brought claims under a specific section of Title III. And stay with me, I'm going to explain this even though it's just a little bit technical. And that claim is under Section 12812184. And this is part of the ADA that's specific to specified transportation services. So we'll be able to talk, we'll talk a little bit more about what that is. But so what happened in this case is that Uber and Lyft filed a motion to dismiss, and we want to walk through what some of those arguments were. So before doing so, just to flesh out a little bit of this Title III background for you. So Title III, of course, prohibits discrimination for people with disabilities. And the thing that we always think about, or at least I know what I always think about when I think of Title III, is the prohibition on discrimination in places of public accommodation. These are our typical businesses that we consider places of public accommodation. And that everything under the ADA there is under a specific requirement, the 12118 part of the statute. But there's a separate part of Title III that is specific to private entities providing certain services. And that includes the specified transportation services that are primarily engaged in the business of transporting people. So again, it's under Title III, but it's a separate section of Title III. And the Department of Transportation has promulgated specific regulations for this separate section of Title III, which has some overlap with traditional places of public accommodation provisions. There's some incorporation of those provisions, but ultimately they're two separate sections. So with that background, I want to walk through a few of the arguments that these ride-sharing companies have been making. So first, Uber said, fine. Okay, well, we're not covered because Title III only applies to places of public accommodation. And then Lyft had a similar argument. They said, okay, well, even if Lyft is, coverage under the specified public transportation service, plaintiffs have to show that Lyft is first a place of public accommodation. So in other words, it was a prerequisite for coverage as a specified transportation service. And the court said, no. It basically kind of explained what I had just explained earlier about the background and said, look, Title III applies, there's two different sections. It's going to apply both to places of public accommodation and to specified transportation services. There are two separate sections. You can qualify under both or one or neither. There's no prerequisite. There's no kind of, you have to qualify for one to qualify for another. So then Uber and Lyft decided to come up with another argument. They said, okay, well, we're not specified public transportation services. Do you want to know why? We don't provide transportation. We are a technology company. What we do is we connect users through our mobile-based ride-sharing platform. So we don't own vehicles. All we're doing is connecting people with one another. And so we're not a specified public transportation service. And this is an argument that, you know, we keep hearing these transportation companies say. Well, the good news for people with disabilities and advocates is that the court said, well, not so fast. If you look at the type of service being offered, these ride-sharing companies are plausibly subjected to the specified public transportation section. So we're not saying absolutely yes, but we're definitely saying not absolutely no. And in making that finding, the court said, you know, the ADA often applies to situations that were not expressly anticipated. So we're not going to dismiss the case on that basis. So that was an exciting finding for people with disabilities. Well, Lyft and Uber weren't done. They next argued, okay, fine, even if we're subject to the specified public transportation service, some of the specific provisions required don't apply to us. So for instance, there's a specific Department of Transportation regulation that you're going to hear us talk about today that requires training of personnel. So Lyft and Uber argued, we don't have personnel. We have drivers. They are just people who connect to our mobile app. They're not our personnel. They're not our employees. And the court said, well, maybe not, but that's not an issue that we can decide today under a motion to dismiss. So it's something that's going to have to be decided further in the future. And then finally, Uber argued, well, we have no ability to require our drivers to modify their personal vehicles or control conditions. So there's really nothing that we can do to force anyone to comply. We have no control over this. Again, all we are is a technology company. All we are is a mobile app to help people. And this is an exciting part of the opinion because the court really disagreed with that. They called Uber's argument disingenuous to argue that it had no control of its drivers and said, you know, look, by its very terms, there's some control over the drivers. And it's evidence that, you know, the court said that Uber requires drivers to have a license. It requires drivers to have car insurance, a clean record, and a four-door vehicle. So, yes, this isn't, you know, the most detailed level of control, but there are some controls that are in place. The court also said that it's definitely plausible that Uber would be able to modify its application to at least connect drivers with individuals who needed a specific type of drivers who had a specific type of vehicle. So what typically happens after a motion sickness is that you get into more substantive discovery, more substantive briefing, and some of these open questions are ultimately answered. Well, that's not going to happen here because after this decision, the case was settled under confidential terms. So this particular litigation is over. But it did answer a couple of questions for us. But of course, it also remains, there's some questions that remain, and that is, okay, well, even if a company is subject to ADA, what's going to be the actual requirement for accessible vehicles? Is there a requirement to acquire an accessible seat, just to connect riders with drivers? These are all the types of challenges that I think we're bound to see moving forward, which are really important issues for people with disabilities. And the second big ride-sharing case that we want to focus on is not about wheelchair-accessible vehicles, but is instead focused on the issue of transporting service animals. So this is a case brought by the National Federation of the Blind in California. It was a case brought against Uber. And here the allegations are that Uber was refusing to transport individuals who had service animals. And there's a couple of examples of the allegations were that when some individuals and passengers were trying to use an Uber, the driver would shout things like "no dogs" and leave, or would absolutely refuse to accept passengers as service animals. So the plaintiffs here brought a claim against those two different provisions that we talked about earlier, the section specifically about places of public accommodation and the section about specified public transportation services. Well, what happened in this case, and I don't know if it was a direct result of the Ramos decision or if it was a result of the Department of Justice Statement of Interest, which we'll talk about, but ultimately Uber filed a motion to dismiss. And it didn't really touch the specified public transportation service argument. All it did was just say that it's not a place of public accommodation under the ADA. And it cited some case law in the Ninth Circuit finding that places of public accommodation have to be physical places. So a lot of the cases that we've seen about website access questioning whether or not something that's not has a physical brick and mortar location can be a place of public accommodation. Well, what happened in this case is that the court denied the motion to dismiss, and so the court said that the plaintiff's claim was able to proceed. And so the court reasoned that there are these 12 different categories of places of public accommodation. And the plaintiff had said there is going to be a place of public accommodation falls within this one category called travel service. The court said, look, the ADA doesn't define travel service. If we look at other courts across the country, there's been a lot of discussion about what a travel service means, and there's been discussion about how a travel service doesn't necessarily have to require a physical structure to qualify as a place of public accommodation. The court went a little bit further to say there's absolutely no binding law out there that Uber is precluded from regulation as a travel service. And so based on all of that rationale, Uber, again, using this lawyer language, plausibly qualifies as a place of public accommodation. And so we have, again, this finding from a court saying, yes, it's very possible that Uber is a place of public accommodation, so it's going to be subject to the specific part of Title III that governs places of public accommodation under the ADA. The update in this case is that the parties are currently in settlement discussions, and so this will be an interesting one to find out what ultimately happens. But it seems like from the docket that they're maybe close to reaching a settlement, so news on this case should be coming forward pretty soon. It's always helpful, especially in these areas of emerging industries, to know what the Department of Justice thinks on any particular issue. And we have a glimpse into DOJ's position because they filed a statement of interest in the NFV versus Uber case. For those who are less familiar, a statement of interest is something that the Department of Justice can file when they have an interest in a case, usually when they want to clarify a specific legal issue, and say, you know, we as the administrative agency that's charged with enforcing the law, charged with promulgating regulations under the law, want to explain a particularly legal issue. And so that's what they did in this in the NFP versus Uber case. And so what DOJ said is what we've seen in these cases. And again, this is filed before the NFP decision came out. So what DOJ said is that an entity can absolutely fall within both the transportation service provider provision and even if they're not a place of public accommodation. And so the DOJ clarified that if you look at this language of the specified transportation provider language of Title III, that it's really broadly defined. It's going to be defined as taxis and other demand responsive transportation services, which of course are going to include these things like Uber and Lyft. They also say that the Department of Transportation regs are broadly defining what it means to operate a service. And so, you know, they didn't really offer an opinion about whether Uber is or is not a place of public accommodation, but they wanted to clarify that these different provisions are, are distinct, and that the specified public transportation provisions are very broad and can certainly include these ride-sharing companies. So in addition to bringing challenges under the ADA, some state and local governments are looking to ensure accessibility of ride-sharing networks through legislation. So a quick disclaimer is that this is certainly not everything about what's happening in the country, but just a kind of a quick snapshot of a few different initiatives that various state and local governments are pursuing. So we wanted to highlight three. One is a bill that was introduced in Georgia, and this bill has specific requirements for the minimum number of wheelchair accessible vehicles, and that would apply, of course, to the transportation network providers. Here in Chicago, there was recently a bill that was an ordinance that was introduced just last month. So we already have an ordinance saying that you have to be able to provide some sort of wheelchair accessible transportation if you're a taxi cab. And right now, there's some ways to connect transportation providers with accessible taxi cabs. The proposed language is actually going to require a minimum of 5% of total vehicles for hire through the digital platform that Uber or Lyft offer to be wheelchair accessible vehicles. So that's going to be, if this ordinance passes, it would be a huge change in the way that these companies operate in Chicago. The ordinance also says that the services offered by these transportation network providers have to be equal in terms of pricing and response time. So it's not enough to just offer the service. It needs to be offered in a comparable way. And finally, there's also an ordinance in Austin, Texas, and it approached the situation in a slightly different way. They created a fund of 10 cents per ride to support passengers who need wheelchair accessible vehicles. And they did other things like conducting outreach events to make sure to publicize the needs for these vehicles. They have accessible services features on the app to make sure that there's a way, again, to connect folks who would like to use wheelchair accessible vehicles with the vehicle themselves. And then they, too, like the Chicago ordinance, are prohibiting a higher fare. So, again, we expect to see more of this type of legislation moving forward. I just wanted to remind folks that in addition to the federal litigation that's going on, there's certainly legislative initiatives. Another hot topic is the question of accessible taxi cabs. And relatedly, what are the obligations of governmental licensing entity? And the top case on this issue is one from a few years ago out of New York City. This is a case called Noel versus New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission. And as a little bit of background, New York City licenses and regulates its taxi cabs, even though taxi cabs themselves are a private industry. And the law in New York limits the number of yellow cabs. At the time that this case was filed, there was a very limited number of accessible cabs. I think the numbers were that 98.2% of the cabs are inaccessible, which, of course, is a huge number. So if you look at how that really impacts people with disabilities, the chances of hailing any cab in Manhattan within 10 minutes was 87%, but the chances of hailing an accessible cab was way, way less at 3%. So you can see a huge disparity in types of service that's being offered. And so the plaintiffs in this case brought a lawsuit, and instead of challenging the taxi cab industry themselves, they actually filed a lawsuit against New York City, saying that the city is failing to give meaningful access to people with disabilities and violating Title II in the way that they were licensing and regulating licensing the industry. Well, we thought this case was going to be good news for people with disabilities because at the initial level, the district court actually found for the plaintiffs, and they granted partial summary judgment, finding that the plaintiffs had proven their case. The court had made a couple findings saying that, yes, New York City had this public entity carrying out this public regulatory function, and so it can't discriminate. And here, it's clear that people with disabilities were not getting meaningful access to the taxi cab industry. However, the New York City appealed, and the decision was vacated by the Second Circuit. So what the Second Circuit said is that, you know, the New York City industry is a private industry. It's not a city program. And yes, there are certain restrictions on how a public entity can administer a license and certification program, but that's not really what was happening here. So the court explained that, you know, if New York City was denying a taxi license to somebody with a disability, then yes, that would be a Title II violation. But here the issue really is what access are the consumers of the licensing product getting? And that's the court found was outside the scope of what Title II was requiring. And the Second Circuit also had distinguished some other cases finding other state entities to be more involved with the regulation and licensing of certain products. So for instance, there's a number of cases saying that lottery commissions have to require each of their retailers to be accessible, or at least on a programmatic basis. And the court found this to be different. And the reason why is that with the lottery cases, the lottery commissions are actually furnishing a state program, as opposed to here, it's more of a straight, clear licensing, as opposed to administering a public transportation service. And the Second Circuit also said, look, if you look at Title III, there's actually an exemption for taxi providers for purchasing accessible vehicles. And so we kind of looked at this case as trying to go in a roundabout way to ensure something that wasn't required under Title III. So what I really want to highlight is what's interesting in this case is what happened next. And that is that there was, in the Second Circuit decision, a footnote saying that the plaintiff might have more force if they were able to allege that New York City had failed to include an accessible model on its list of possible vehicles for taxi cab drivers. And the plaintiff just suggested that that was something that might happen because New York City was coming up with a program called Taxi for Tomorrow, where there was going to be one universal taxi cab vehicle. Surprise, surprise, what happens next? The plaintiff sought to amend their complaint, and the court allowed them to do so. And what the plaintiff said was that, just as the Second Circuit had suggested, New York City was planning to select a particular vehicle as the exclusive cab vehicle for the next decade, and that vehicle was not accessible to individuals who use wheelchairs. So after that, the parties quickly announced the settlement agreement, and it was a really exciting settlement for people with disabilities. The settlement required there to be a phase-in of accessible wheelchair cabs, but by 2020, there are supposed to be 50% accessible cabs, which again is an exciting progress made in New York City. I wanted to talk about two other cases and settlements with respect to cabs. The first is the Department of Justice agreement, and here we have an individual, Mr. Bernie, who is a blind individual, uses a service animal, and he alleged to the Department of Justice that he was denied taxi cab service by a particular driver who owned a cab. And the cab driver herself admitted that she did, in fact, exclude the individual, but she claimed she didn't know he was blind, and that she didn't know that the dog that was with him was a service animal. Well, Department of Justice got involved, and they reached an agreement. And it looks like a lot of the agreements that we see from the Department of Justice is a change of policy. And so this cab driver was required to have a service animal policy that welcomed all passengers, prohibited her from requiring folks to pay a surcharge, even if she already had a surcharge for transportation of a pet, of course, because service animals are not pets. They also required her to undergo some training and pay some monetary relief, $1,000 to the complainant and $1,000 to the United States as a civil penalty. We have a link on the bottom of this slide to both this particular agreement and also to another taxicab agreement. And finally, we wanted to flag a pending case that we think is a case of interest for everyone to keep an eye out for, and this is a case called Stokes versus Total Transit Inc., or TTI. In this case, there was a class action that was brought against one of the largest cab companies in Arizona. The reason this case was brought was that TTI was imposing a $10 surcharge per trip using any van. What makes this case a little bit interesting is that this $10 surcharge applied regardless of whether the van had a lift or ramp, and it applied regardless of whether the customer required a lift or a ramp. And the second wrinkle is that the surcharge wasn't necessarily applied if the customer hailed the cab, but this still had this adverse impact on people with disabilities, much like in the New York case, because it's disproportionately difficult to hail an accessible cab as it is to hail a cab that doesn't have accessibility features. So when asked to explain why we have this surcharge, TTI said that there's a couple different reasons. One is that it had to basically compensate drivers for the additional fuel inefficiency of vans, but then there's also a disability-related reason. TTI explained that there was additional time required to carry a wheelchair. So some of the claims that the plaintiffs are raising in this case is that TTI is violating the specified public transportation provision of Title III because they're purchasing new vans that are not accessible, which is plainly in violation of the requirements. The plaintiffs are also arguing that they're charging this additional fee, which is amounting to a surcharge for passengers with disabilities. And even if they're going to charge that $10 fee, under the ADA, they should be modifying that policy to make sure that people with disabilities are able to access the transportation services in an equitable way. There's also an allegation that $10 is establishing eligibility criteria, screening out people with disabilities. And then there's also a retaliation component. After this company was threatening to stop its dispatch service for all vans if there was going to be a challenge with this $10 charge. And so the plaintiff included a retaliation case as well. So this case, again, is also currently in discovery, but it's an exciting case moving forward and one that we encourage those interested in these issues to keep an eye out for. So again, I'm going to turn the presentation back to Barry to talk about public transportation.
Thanks, Rachel. So the next few slides are just going to be talking about some odds and ends, different cases that fall into the broader category of public transportation. The first one is not an Air Carrier Access Act case, which deals with airlines, but instead about the actual airport accessibility, which is covered by Title II or III, depending on the state or local government airport. This was the case under Title II, actually, in Michigan. And what happened here was the airport was going to relocate its drop-off pickup location for buses from an accessible area that where arrivals were to an inaccessible grounds transportation center. And so two people with disabilities challenged this under Title II of the ADA, and a settlement was reached where they agreed to make the ground transportation center more accessible for folks and safer because they were going to have to cross traffic. And so at the bottom, you'll see a link to the settlement. But what's really interesting about this is what happened next. And that is, after the case was filed, a couple of the bus entities that had assisted the plaintiffs and filed affidavits supporting their concerns about accessibility, they felt like they were retaliated for doing this and they filed their own suit under the ADA. So you might remember Title V of the ADA contains a retaliation provision, and it's a cause of action for individuals who oppose an act or practice made unlawful by the ADA. So the classic example is when, say, an employee files a charge with the EEOC for denial of a reasonable accommodation, and then they're filed for exercising their ADA rights. That's a retaliation claim, and that's separate from the underlying ADA claim that you would make originally on discrimination. Well, the case law is clear that you don't have to show you're a person with a disability to bring a retaliation claim. You just have to be an individual, because it talks about individuals as opposed to people with disabilities. But in this case, the question is, what constitutes an individual? Can an entity, like a bus company, bring a retaliation claim? And so that was the issue before the court. And basically, the court said no, even though it appears that there was evidence that the airport did retaliate against these bus companies, there is no ADA claim because the plaintiffs themselves are not individuals protected from retaliation. So even though they were retaliated against for helping people with disabilities in their discrimination claim, the bus companies themselves did not have a right under the ADA to bring suit. The next case we're going to talk about is actually a case that was resolved through what are called structured negotiations, where litigation actually isn't filed. This is a case that was brought on an agreement that was reached down in Houston with respect to the Houston Transit Agency and their accessibility, online accessibility. There were two riders who were blind, and they were represented by Lainey Feingold, who came up with this concept for structured negotiations, as well as our sister agency in Texas, Disability Rights Texas. And what they did was these individuals and two legal advocates brought to Houston Metro's attention that they had accessibility problems. And Houston Metro said, okay, we'll work with you to resolve this amicably as opposed to having to go through litigation. And that's where the structured negotiations came through. And so what Houston's agreed to do is to ensure that its website and its mobile app complies with the web content accessibility guidelines. They were supposed to have done that by the end of last year in December. They also agreed to make sure their materials that they provide are available in alternate formats, like in Braille or in large print or tape. They also said that if CAPTCHAs are used, there'll be an alternative security measure. Now, hopefully folks know what CAPTCHAs are. If you're not aware of that, that's when you're online and you have to type in some sort of code. It's basically trying to keep hackers and computerized entities from going through websites, and it's basically just checking to make sure you're a human. But oftentimes when you have to type in these codes, if you're a person with a visual impairment, it's not accessible. And so there are buttons you can place on these CAPTCHAs that will allow you to hear the instructions audibly, and then you can enter the code appropriately. So that has to be added to their site. Also, their PDF documents and electronic forms are going to be made accessible. You're also required to develop a website policy and identify a web accessibility coordinator, and they've also agreed to do usability testing and staff training. So really a complete overhaul of the electronic information by the Houston Transit Agency, which is really exciting. And if you want more details, there's a link to the agreement at the bottom of this slide. We also wanted to point out sort of another way that transportation can be addressed, and this is an investigation by the Department of Justice, which has oversight of Title II, including the transportation provisions of Title II. And what this is a letter of finding, meaning that the Department of Justice is authorized to investigate and request that an entity take corrective actions, and they do this before filing suit. And so this is what happened when they did an investigation of the Virgin Islands public transportation system. And you'll see a link on the top of this page to the actual letter of finding. But I just wanted to go through because what it does is it highlights a lot of the different issues that arise in public transportation under Title II. One of the big problems with Title II in the Virgin Islands were their fixed route system. And you know, obviously it's a much smaller system, but only half of the buses on St. Thomas at operable lifts, and so they said they were waiting for parts for months. And the regulations say that you have to repair wheelchair lifts promptly when they're out of order, and that certainly wasn't happening. And the regulations also talk about swapping in vehicles when you don't have the parts available, and that wasn't happening either. They also found that the Virgin Islands was failing to regularly and frequently perform maintenance checks as required by the ADA regulations. So we're supposed to check the lift before the bus goes out and at the end of the day when the bus comes back to the bus barn, and they found that that was not happening on a regular basis. Other issues with respect to their buses, you might remember that the ADA requires that transportation entities call out stops for people with visual impairments. And what the Virgin Islands was doing is they were only calling out stops upon request rather than calling it out at each stop as required. And that was a violation of the Department of Transportation regulations, which say you shall call out the stop, not upon request. And they found that by having this sort of upon request component, it discouraged riders from using fixed route system. And in fact, they interviewed riders with disabilities and said they no longer were going to ride mainline because calling out the stops is not done routinely. Then they also found that the securement devices, which are required, weren't in place. Buses that are over 22 feet are supposed to have at least two securement devices, and they found that none of the five buses on one particular island had the two requirements, and one didn't even have one securement device. And so drivers, when they would, a person in a wheelchair would try to board, they'd say, we can't let you board because we don't have sufficient securement. And so people were being denied access that way as well. In addition to problems with their main line, they also have problems with their paratransit provision or service as well. Paratransit provisions say that regulations say that you're supposed to meet 100% demand for next day ride, and this was not happening. And in fact, they showed that the demand was increasing for paratransit, but the budget was decreasing, and the Virgin Islands was failing to supplement this increased demand with new vehicles and not hiring new drivers, and they were really just stagnant despite the increased demand. They were also inappropriately charging more than double for paratransit. Under paratransit, you're allowed to charge double the mainline fare. Here, the mainline fare was 75 cents, and they were charging $2, which is more than twice, so that was a violation. And they found that the paratransit pickups were frequently untimely, supposed to be within 30 minutes, 15 minutes before or after, and they were late 22% of the time. They also found that the paratransit was in the Virgin Islands was incorrectly implementing the provisions on companion riders. The regulations require riders to allow have one companion and one personal care attendant, and Virgin Islands would only permit companions if space was available, which is impermissible. They were also restricting kids under certain ages, which also is not permissible under the ADA. They also had very restrictive reservation policies. The regs are very clear that the service hours are supposed to be comparable to normal service hours. Here they had shortened service hours, so you couldn't make a reservation after 4 or 4:30, even though the regular transportation service was open till 5 o'clock. And they also didn't let people make reservations for Monday rides the day before on Sunday because they were closed. And even though Sunday's closed, they weren't allowing people to make reservations for Monday by calling on Saturday either. So people basically couldn't get a ride on Monday at all. They also found that the Virgin Islands was failing to train personnel, not only on the equipment and how those are supposed to be used in the vehicles, but also with respect to how they interact with people with disabilities and being respectful and courteous, which is laid out in the regulations as well. And so this letter of finding lays out all these different violations and a plan of corrections to address all of them. And no suit's been filed by the Department of Justice, so presumably the Virgin Islands is working to address those plans and requests for corrections. You might remember in previous trainings we've done, we talked about when you can bring suit, when you have standing to bring suit. And one of the things you have to do when you're bringing standing under the ADA is you have to show that there's going to be some sort of likelihood of future injury. And we often see this when people are accessing certain businesses that are inaccessible, like restaurants or stores, and they have to prove that they're going to come back to that place in order to bring a case under the ADA. Well, this is applying that same concept to transportation with respect to Amtrak. The plaintiff in this case used a wheelchair. She can't stand or walk for more than 3 to 5 minutes, and she was riding Amtrak from Florida to New York. And she had made plans for Amtrak to meet her with the wheelchair and attendant, but that person was not present. And when they did find her, they had a wheelchair that was too small for her, and they also left her unattended in a wheelchair that she couldn't operate. So she filed suit under Section 504. And the court dismissed the case originally saying she had no standing because she hadn't displayed an intent to return to Amtrak. Well, this got appealed up to the Second Circuit, and they actually found in favor of the plaintiff and said, well, she is intending to patronize Amtrak again. The complaint clearly stated her desire to use Amtrak services both for her own pleasure as well as to be a tester. And they also said that, you know, unlike the restaurant cases or store cases where you have lots of choices, there's only one national railway system. And so really, if she wants to travel by train through different states, Amtrak's the only way she's going to do. And in fact, she gave evidence that she had used Amtrak in the past, that she lived in the city with an Amtrak station, and that for intercity travel, really, that was what the only option was Amtrak. So the court found it was reasonable to infer that the plaintiff intended to use Amtrak again if the violations that she had not had a remedy. And so therefore, they found that she did meet the standing requirement of the intent to return and could go forward with her ADA case. We also wanted to give you a heads up about a case that was filed recently, one of the plaintiffs being our sister agency in Maryland, the PNA there. And this is a case, Freeman versus Smith, and this is a paratransit case where they found really a couple of big issues in Maryland. One was that the eligibility criteria was being inappropriately addressed. So for instance, they were failing to assess comprehensively and accurately why somebody would need to use paratransit as opposed to fixed route. And they were saying that if you could use fixed route sometimes, then you weren't eligible for paratransit. And that's clearly not correct because sometimes people can use fixed route, but because of the nature of the disability, they can't at other times. And they were also failing to state specificity the reasons for denying that eligibility. And they laid out a really compelling case. One of their plaintiffs, Mr. Freeman, who had end-stage renal failure, and they gave an example that he was even being assessed for paratransit, and during the assessment his blood pressure skyrocketed and they had to call the paramedics. And even though he had had all these medical issues, they still denied his application, saying that he had used public transportation fixed route in the past, therefore he wasn't eligible for paratransit. And this was bizarre because they had found him eligible for paratransit in the past and nothing had really changed, so there was no basis for finding him ineligible. It just sounded like they were really tightening the screws and using more inappropriate eligibility criteria than they had in the past. And so that was the basis for the suit. There was also concerns about the scheduling of paratransit ride and that they were consistently putting capacity constraints. People just couldn't get through to make their paratransit reservations. And so Maryland had been promising to fix their telephone call operations, but they just kept not doing it and people kept having problems. You would often call to make a reservation and you either couldn't get through or you get a busy signal. They had evidence even that 95% of people who called during the busiest hour got a busy signal, and when you called generally, 57% of people were getting busy signals. So it was just very frustrating for Maryland riders with disabilities. And so this case was brought to address that issue as well as the eligibility issue. The status, though, is that Maryland, the person here had filed a motion for preliminary injunction to get the court to find preliminarily that they that the Maryland Transit Authority needs to change its practices, but apparently the parties started engaging in settlement negotiations, so the judge dismissed that motion for preliminary injunction without prejudice, saying you can refile it if the case doesn't settle, and so far the settlement negotiations must be continuing because nothing has further happened in the case. And then the last thing I just wanted to bring up are a couple of changes with respect to Department of Transportation policy issues. One is that the Federal Transit Authority has issued a circular. It's a really long document. It's 306 pages, but we wanted to point it out because it goes through a lot of different things on how to comply with disability laws. And so transit entities that are having problems should refer to this because it's very detailed and very specific on different components of transportation. There's a whole section on training, talking about how to train people on consistently and reliably operating accessibility features, how to provide appropriate assistance to people with disabilities, how to treat them with respect and in a courteous way. It goes over technical tasks as well as the human relations component. It emphasizes not only about training new people, new workers, but also retraining and doing refresher training for existing employees, both on existing issues as well as when new accessible features are added, such as when they purchase new vehicles. So I would really encourage folks, if you want to, both transit entities as well as advocates and people with disabilities, to check this circular out. There's a nice table of contents, so you can go to different issues, but it really lays out a lot of very practical guidance on how to address a variety of issues. The other thing that has happened recently in 2015 is the Department of Transportation has resolved an issue that's been sort of an uncertain issue within the courts. You might remember that under Title II, it's divided into two parts, state and local governments as well as transportation. And under the state and local government provision, the Department of Justice has always been clear that state and local governments are required to provide reasonable modifications to its programs and services. What was unclear, though, was what about the other part of Title II, the transportation provisions? Is there a reasonable modification requirement for that as well? And many had argued no, because the transportation provisions are very specific and detailed and doesn't specifically reference a reasonable modification component. And so transit agencies were saying, look, as long as we can comply with what's laid out in the statute and the regulations, we don't have to provide reasonable modifications. That's enough. And there's been litigation trying to resolve this issue, and the courts have gone different ways. Probably the most famous case is a case out of Texas, Melton versus Dallas Area Rapid Transit. And in that case, the plaintiff was a paratransit user and wanted to be picked up in the alley behind the house instead of in the front of the house because of the front of the house being very inaccessible and the slope was very difficult for the person to navigate. And because the regulations say that your transit providers are supposed to pick up in the front of the house, they said, we are not going to modify our policy and pick you up behind because we're complying with the regulations. And the court, the circuit said, right, there is no reasonable modification provision under that part of Title II, the transportation provisions. And so the Supreme Court denied to hear that case, and so this uncertainty has existed for quite a while. And finally, the Department of Transportation has clarified that and issued this new rule that makes clear that reasonable modifications are required under Title II's provisions for transportation, and you have a link to that. And so now I think we have a much clearer guideline from the federal courts, the Federal Transit Agency that enforces this provision of the ADA, that reasonable modifications are required to be provided by transit entities. And so with that, I will turn it back over to Rachel to do the final session on private transportation, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Great. Thanks, Barry. So moving on to private transportation, the first consent decree that we want to talk about is this really newsworthy and recent agreement between the United States Department of Justice and Greyhound. This has been getting a lot of press because of the pretty significant monetary relief and the systemic changes. Getting a little ahead of myself, let's back up. So the Department of Justice had alleged that Greyhound had violated Title III of the ADA by failing to provide full and equal enjoyment of its transportation services and by engaging in a pattern or practice of discrimination. So I want to highlight a few of the examples of violations that DOJ has classified. DOJ said that Greyhound was not maintaining its accessible features like lifts and procurement devices. It was failing to provide passengers with disabilities assistance in boarding and also in exiting at rest stops. And it was not enabling people with disabilities to be able to make reservations online for accessible buses. So what happened is that they reached a comprehensive settlement agreement. And first, to start with the monetary relief, there's a $300,000 compensation that's being provided already to passengers the Department of Justice has already identified. But there's also a claims administrator, and what that claims administrator is going to do is going to be evaluating complaints filed by other impacted people, and the idea is that this fund is going to compensate an uncapped number of people who experienced discrimination within the last 3 years, and the fund itself is uncapped. And so what that means for you or for anyone that you know who has a disability that's had a negative experience with Greyhound that's violated the law is that you'll want to go onto the site, the claims administer site, and submit your claim for relief under this agreement. In addition to that monetary relief that goes to already identified unidentified passengers, Greyhound is paying a $75,000 fine to the government. And I can't say for certain, but I suspect that this is one of the highest settlements that the Department of Justice has ever reached with respect to an ADA violation. So in addition to that monetary relief, the agreement is also calling for really substantial systemic reforms. Because of this agreement, Greyhound is agreeing to basically remedy a lot of the complaints that I had just outlined. They're going to maintain their accessibility features, make sure that they're in operative condition, their lifts and their other securement devices. Another hugely important change is that they're going to change the reservation system to make sure that it's equivalent to people with disabilities. So for instance, now people with disabilities will be able to go on their online system and be able to actually check if they're traveling in a wheelchair or traveling with a service animal or if they need another sort of accommodation under the ADA. And of course now in our world of doing everything online, this is a great change, a really important change for equitable service for people with disabilities. Greyhound is also going to make sure that there are assisting people who need assistance with the use of different procurement devices, and including assistance in boarding and deboarding both at the initial stop, final stop, and at rest stops. And of course, they're not going to require that people schedule trips, reschedule trips because they're not being able to get the accessible service. Hopefully the service is still done via accessible. And as we see in a lot of these agreements, Greyhound's going to hire an ADA compliance manager. And so that's a really great way to really make sure that change is being effectuated because there's going to be one point person. Complaints, questions can all go to one person who's charged with knowing this information. And we find that to be a successful way to make sure that compliance is realized. A couple other requirements, there's going to be a training for all employees and contractors on the ADA. And in addition to this ADA training, there's going to be a very technical training about the proper operation of accessibility features. So again, when staff is trained to assist people with disabilities, they know what they're doing and they're providing that the assistance in a safe and respectful way. Greyhound's going to report every 3 months on its compliance efforts, and it's also going to create a system where people with disabilities are able to file complaints through its online booking system to make sure that there's a way to monitor how things are going. On the bottom of slide 57, we've got two links. One is consent decree, if you want to read more of the details. But then two is to this claims administer site. And this site is up, it's live, and folks need to submit their claim, I believe, before November. So if that's something that has impacted you or someone that you know, we encourage you to check it out. So most cases that we've talked about today have really been about transportation companies themselves. Of course, there are more traditional places of public accommodation that offer transportation services as one of their services, and that's exactly what's happened in this case, the Civil Rights Education and Enforcement Center versus RLJ Lodging Trust. This is a case that was brought against a hotel. As we all know, hotels offer hospitality, and a lot of times they offer transportation. And that's what was happening here. This hotel is a nationwide chain. It had 127 hotels, and not all of them, but 42 of them provided transportation services to their guests. So the ADA and the Department of Justice, or Department of Transportation regulations, do have accessibility requirements in that circumstance. The regs say that the hotels have to either purchase accessible vehicles or provide equivalent services in providing wheelchair custom transportation services. And what the specific requirements are vary based on the size of the vehicle, when the vehicle has been acquired, and whether there's an on-demand versus responsive system. Well, what happened here is that after this lawsuit was filed, the parties reached the class settlement agreement. And in the settlement agreement, the hotel agreed to, one, comply with the Department of Transportation regulations, They also agreed that they're going to provide accurate information to hotel guests, which we all know is so important. When someone calls and asks about the current state of accessibility, it's crucial to be able to relay accurate information. And finally, they agreed to provide equivalent accessible transportation service. And more than that, it actually defines what equivalent is. And it takes the definition pretty much from the Department of Transportation regulations, which says that this equivalent service has to be, again, the same with respect to schedules, response times, fares, geographic service areas, hours, days of service, availability, and reservation capabilities, among other things. So really, if we're going to provide this service, it has to be equivalent. Because this is a class settlement, one thing that happens, unlike an individual settlement, is that the plaintiffs and accessible parties have to submit the class settlement to court for approval. And so what's nice about that is that we sometimes with a settlement don't get the judge's perspective, but in class settlements, many times courts will write an opinion evaluating the fairness of the settlement. And so we have that opinion here, and what happened was the court granted preliminary approval to this class action settlement in addition to certifying the settlement class. And so one thing that the court did is, you know, talk about whether or not the agreement was fair, finding it to be fair. But the other thing that was really interesting in this case is something that's kind of following along with what Barry had said earlier with respect to standing. Again, we see in a lot of ADA cases this issue of whether plaintiffs have the ability to actually pursue an ADA case, but whether they're going to plan to return. And then a secondary issue is that, well, what happens if the person wants to return, but one of the reasons they want to return is because they want to test ADA accessibility. They're, in other words, a tester, an ADA tester. And there's some pretty good case law out there about the issue of testers having standing, and then this case really provided additional support for that proposition and said that, yes, testers have standing to pursue injunctive relief, and they're agreeing with a couple other circuits on that issue. And they said really clearly that plaintiffs are not going to lose standing just because their motive in patronizing a place is to test for compliance. And here, the plaintiffs had standing because they testified that they would go back to these hotels if there was equivalent accessible transportation. So it was a great decision, and we wanted to note that there was kind of a second case against Ashford Hospitality. The site is here below, where the same plaintiffs got a very similar case on a very similar issue and reached very similar results. And the court also approved that settlement and discussed the standing issues as well. Next, we wanted to highlight three more Department of Justice settlement agreements about private transportation, and I'm going to kind of speak through these pretty quickly so that we can have a little bit of time for questions. So the first is against Autobuses Regio Montanos. Check my pronunciation there. But this settlement agreement was an exciting one because it was entered by the Department of Justice as a private transportation bus company. And some of the allegations were the same things that we've been talking about. There's been this failure to perform maintenance checks, provide accessible service, if there wasn't a lift accessible bus, provide this training, and file these reports. And so as a result of the settlement, this bus company is agreeing to do all of those changes. They're going to have an ADA training. They're going to ensure that their lifts are properly maintained. And they're going to file the ADA compliance reports with the Department of Transportation. We also had this Department of Justice settlement with Super Shuttle. And this was about accessibility for service animals. It's kind of an interesting twist on surcharges. So in this case, the complainant had booked a specific type of Super Shuttle where she was going to share with some colleagues, but also share with others. And so it was a cheaper type of service. It was only $91. But as soon as the Super Shuttle employee saw that she had a service animal, they essentially required her to have a more expensive type of trip. They said that they needed to have an exclusive trip, not with others, because no one would want to travel with a service animal. I don't know where they got that, but that was what they said. And what's interesting is that Super Shuttle actually did have a policy about service animals, but clearly there was a lack of training, and that policy was not followed in this case, which ultimately led DOJ to conclude that, yes, there was this violation and there was this unnecessary surcharge, even though the surcharge wasn't what we typically think, that, you know, you have to pay an additional cost. It was more of you have to actually pay for a more expensive service. And so they found that to be a surcharge as well. And so to remedy that issue, there was an agreement where Super Shuttle, of course, is going to amend their service animal policy, and they're going to clarify that there can be no additional surcharges. And that policy is distributed to all employees and all franchises. There's going to be a service animal welcome sign in, you know, a very clear location at each guest center, which is going to be a really effective way to educate. There's going to be training for all personnel, and there is a monetary payment to the complainant. We have links to the policy and to the service animal welcome sign, because we find that Department of Justice agreements sometimes are a great starting point for companies to come up with their own policies. So links to that are on the slide 62. And then the final DOJ agreement we wanted to reference is this case with DC Trails. And here, it's kind of more of the same, but here they found a lot of the same problems that they were finding. The fleet wasn't accessible, inaccessible buses were being used, and there was no training on how to use these the different types of procurement devices. And so there was an agreement where, you know, we see this compliance with all the Department of Transportation regulations. They're only going to be using wheelchair accessible coaches for sick service, and that's whether it's operating it or operating under a contract. And there used to be, it's kind of interesting, there used to be, you know, written materials from this company saying that passengers needed to provide advance notice. And so the Department of Justice agreement actually said, you know, to this company, you need to go through and remove all of those written materials and create new written materials to make sure that passengers know the current state of the accessibility of your company, so that there's no advance notice requirement required. And there's also training requirements, again, to make sure that people are aware of what the ADA requirement is and how to comply with those requirements. And then finally, we just have a case to watch. It's kind of an interesting interplay between the typical public accommodation world and places of transportation. This is a case from their sister agency out in Ohio. Here there was a mall, and for many, many years, 30 years, the mall actually allowed the local transportation company to operate a bus stop and to stop right by the mall's entrance. So it was very accessible to individuals with disabilities. Well, about 13 years ago in 2003, the mall changed its policies with respect to public transportation, and they moved the bus stop all the way to the back of the parking lot. And so this was really problematic for people with disabilities, because people were forced to navigate through this parking lot that was over off field. There was no crosswalks or other sorts of protective measures. And so this complaint was brought by individuals with social mobility and vision-related disabilities seeking to move the bus stop to closer to the mall's entrance. So the current status is that the defendants have filed a motion to dismiss, which is currently pending, but another case to kind of keep your eye out for, because it raises some interesting issues. So with that, I will turn the floor back to the operator or Robin to help us with some questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions at this time, please press the star then one key on your touchtone telephone.
Great. Well, thank you. We got a few minutes here to take a couple of questions. One here is, if someone with a disability using a paratransit is further than 3/4 mile from the fixed route, does the transit agency still have to track or report on timelines of their pickup or drop-off?
I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head as far as the tracking, so we're having to look through that and follow up with you, Robin.
Okay. And operator, can you give instructions for asking questions again? Are there any questions from the telephone?
Just a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question on the phone line, please press the star and number 1 key on your touchtone telephone.
Okay, while we're waiting, states here on slide 19, you stated that there are 3 questions that can be asked for a service dog owner. This person was taught that there are only 2 are lawful. I didn't think you could ask them to perform those tasks on command. Could you please clarify?
Yeah, I think what is maybe a little confusing is what we're talking about is what DOT has put out as opposed to what DOJ has put out. And so this is what DOT has put out with respect to service animals and people on the on planes. And again, it's not, they're not actually required to show how they would do it. Instead, it's describing how the animal performs the task and function. So you look back at the questions that talks about the functions they perform for you, how they've been individually trained, and describe how they perform that function for you. So it's not an actual demonstration, but more of a description.
Great. Are there any calls from the telephone, or any questions from the telephone?
I'm sorry, no questions.
Okay. Here's a question. What about the issue of parking shuttles from parking lots in airports? This person says, I cannot recall ever seeing one that was wheelchair accessible.
Well, I think what we would have is, and Rachel can chime in here as well. She knows parking maybe a little bit better than I do, but is that there certainly are parking accessibility requirements for entities that have public parking, including airport shuttles or airports themselves. And so I think they would have the same requirements in the ADA that other entities that have parking would have.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's a Title II issue of, in general for transportation services. Just an individual who stating that they should have given you a heads up about something that DOT has issued a notice early this month stating that they will be convening a negotiated rulemaking committee on three issues. One, accessible restrooms in single aisle aircraft, two, in-flight entertainment, and three, other information and whether to amend the regulations. For example, advanced notice requirements, medical verification, and whether the verification should be required for psychiatric service dogs, as well as additional discussion of service animals and emotional support animals and psychiatric service dogs. So it appears that there's some additional discussion going on. Again, this is a negotiated rulemaking committee that has been convened or been put into South America and is considering these issues.
Yeah, I think we actually talked about that when we talked about the notice of intent that was published in December. And we listed the ones that we saw, which were three different categories, which included some of the ones the poster had mentioned. And what our understanding is that that was published in December of 2015. People could submit comments through December 7th of 2015. People could submit comments to January 6th, 2016. And then the committee is conducting the interviews and the investigation and is going to be providing recommendations to DOT. We identified were accessibility of in-flight entertainment, supplemental medical oxygen, service animals, accessible laboratories on single-aisle aircraft, seating accommodations, and carrier recording of disability service requests. But there may be more that have come out since we looked at the notice from December.
Yeah, it's probably an ongoing issue for sure. And this is a question a little bit off, we're at the end of the hour here, but can you discuss a little bit more in detail appropriate inquiries into the reasonableness of emotional support animals in the context of requests made by DOT versus requests for reasonable accommodation in the workplace for an emotional support? Is there any case law on emotional support animals in an employment context? That's a little bit off the track, but I think it raises questions when you start talking about emotional support animals in any context.
Sure. And you know, that's a good point that people make. Sometimes people get confused and think the ADA would only apply to sort of traditional service animals, and that's really looking at the Department of Justice guidelines on those issues. But I think the person is raising an interesting issue, and that is, well, employment may be different, and there may be different provisions, and we don't have specific rules from the EEOC with respect to accommodating people in the workplace and accommodations of emotional support animals versus the sort of traditional service animals that the Department of Justice has defined. I think that the main issue here is kind of like any other reasonable accommodation request. So for any reasonable accommodation request, including bringing an emotional support animal, the request has to be something that, you know, you're allowed to ask both to confirm the disability as well as to confirm the need for the accommodation and any link between the accommodation and the disability if it's not readily apparent. And so employers are entitled to get information both about the disability and the reasonable accommodation request, which would be, you know, I would think confirmation of the person's psychiatric disability, and then also confirmation that an emotional support animal would address the issue in the workplace that they're having a hard time dealing with. So if it's stressed or attendance, then that emotional support animal would help that. They would need to have some sort of professional to make that link for them. And then, of course, any information that the employer gets has to be kept confidential, just like on other parts of reasonable accommodation under the ADA.
Great. Thank you. And so we are at the bottom of the hour. I know this is a very information-packed session with lots of detail, as this is obviously a complex topic, and we're glad that people were interested in it. We identified this topic as something that hadn't been covered a lot in a lot of different areas, so we were hopeful that this would meet people's needs, and obviously by the interest in the questions that were submitted, it does. So thank you very much. I want to thank Rachel and Barry for providing their time and expertise on this particular topic, and again, to all of you as well. So at this time, again, we're done with the session. We do not have our next session established for May. We've had some scheduling conflicts. We'll announce it. Watch the website, watch the email announcements, et cetera, as to what the May session is. We do already have a June session set. Again, you can go to www.ada-audio.org and look at the schedule as it is being developed for the remaining upcoming months. Again, thank you everyone for your participation, and this concludes today's session.